From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We start this week with a tour of some recent science headlines, compliments of our friends at the journal Nature. Flora Graham is editor of the Nature Briefing, and she joins me now on the line from London. Flora, good to talk with you.
Hello.
Flora, when we first learned last year that a scientist had used the gene editing technology CRISPR to modify human embryos, and there were two gene-edited babies, there was shock and concern on a number of fronts, many of them just the ethics of having done that at all. But one was the concern that the particular edit that he had made might actually be dangerous for those babies. Can you tell us now, we have more evidence that this might be the case. What is that edit and what is the concern about it?
What this fellow did is he disabled two copies of a gene called CCR5. And people who have that mutation naturally are known to have some protection against HIV. So that's why he says that he did it. But there is some evidence that there are other both positive and negative knock-on effects to having two disabled copies of this gene. Now, some other researchers have done an analysis of a large group of people, a large data set, and found that people who do have this mutation are quite a bit more likely, 21% more likely to die before the age of 76 than are people who have at least one working copy of the gene.
So what does this mean for those babies who were born with this double mutation and potentially for the larger field of gene editing, if anything?
Well, for these babies in particular, we can't say necessarily. We don't know why specifically people with this double mutation seem to die younger. And we can't say exactly what will happen to these specific children. It's not a tarot card that's going to predict their future. But what we can say is that it feeds into the wider controversy. One of the many reasons why the wider scientific community doesn't think we should be doing this kind of gene editing in this way. And it's interesting to note that this is one of the ways that China has chosen to draft new regulations against this type of gene editing. China's bringing in new rules that says that scientists will be responsible for these types of negative knock-on effects that people might have.
So the scientist who made those edits could be personally liable.
Exactly. That's what the proposed changes to the civil code in China say.
Okay, on a different note, but another really interesting biomedicine and health story. There's a young woman with a very aggressive form of ALS. It's already killed her twin sister, and she may be poised to get a new form of gene therapy that's never been used in humans. What's the situation there?
Well, this would actually be the second case ever where this type of therapy has been used. It hasn't been used in ALS before. In her case, she's got this very aggressive early onset form of the disease. It's certainly ultimately fatal, and she's got very few other options. So the way this treatment is hoped to work is scientists have actually crafted a specific tailored molecule that's going to go into the nucleus of her cells. It's going to bond with her RNA. And the idea is that it's going to turn off the mutation that causes her ALS. It's going to hopefully stop or reduce the production of a protein that's bonding to receptors in her body and causing this damage to her motor system.
This, you said, is not the first. It's the second potential use, but it's never been used to treat this disease before. Do we have any sense of how likely it is to work?
Well, the only other case when this has been used, it was for a different rare disease. But in that case, it did seem to slow the progression of the disease. Now, this is very, very early days for this type of treatment, so there are a lot of question marks around it. But that does seem to be a promising result.
So why is this a news story? Why is this not just the natural progress of we have a treatment, it worked for one disease, it might work for this other disease, we're going to try it in an extreme case? What makes this really noteworthy?
The interesting thing about this treatment is it's completely custom. This is custom built for her cells and for her genetics. Now, this kind of treatment is certainly not going to be rolled out across the board anytime soon. You can imagine it takes a lot of time and a lot of money to produce this kind of custom treatment. So in medicine in general, there's a huge enthusiasm and there's a lot of energy for this type of custom treatment. But what you have to keep in mind is this kind of treatment is not cheap.
Flora Graham, the last story we wanted to talk with you about this week is, well, you know, it's research on cold fusion, which I have to say, even saying that phrase, you almost think it's a joke. It seems like something that has been ruled out time and time again. And yet, since 2015, Google's been funding research on cold fusion. What are they looking at specifically, and what do they hope to learn that we don't already know?
Well, as we all know, fusion is the engine that powers stars like our sun. And you can only imagine that's a very attractive prospect when it comes to generating energy that we could use in our daily lives. So maybe it's no surprise that there's always been a hardcore of people who've clung to the hope that cold fusion experiments, specifically one big experiment that took place in the late 80s, maybe did offer some hint that it's possible to create a system, maybe a chemical system, where more energy comes out than the electricity you put in. The problem is the original finding was so controversial and so thoroughly disproven that the whole subject basically became taboo. Very few scientists are interested in associating their careers with the idea of that kind of star-like fusion that could operate outside of the star environment. But Google, being of deep pockets and interested in trying new things, has spent the past 4 years funding groups of scientists to try to replicate this specific experiment. Now, I immediately must say this does not give much hope to those people who've kind of clung to it over the last 30 years. They found no evidence whatsoever for cold fusion. But they did find some useful experimental things, like very, very accurate ways of measuring energy, for example.
So maybe not a success in the sense of validating cold fusion, but definitely some benefits perhaps coming out of this work.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the benefits is just to slightly lift the taboo on this whole subject and say that reputable scientists can put their time into something, certainly not trying to debunk any conspiracy theories or anything like that, but genuinely apply the scientific method and the theories of reproducibility and see what really comes out of it and answer some longstanding questions.
Flora Graham is the editor of Nature Briefing. Flora, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Alzheimer's disease is a leading cause of death and affects an estimated 5.5 million Americans. Decades of research have greatly improved our understanding of how the disease develops in the brain, from plaques of a protein called amyloid beta to tangles of another protein called tau, and finally to inflammation in the brain and the familiar symptoms of dementia. Yet despite all that's been learned, there is no cure. There aren't even effective treatments. And more drug trials were stopped this spring when they weren't producing the hoped-for results. Still, one leading Alzheimer's researcher says he thinks we're seeing the light. Rudy Tanzi is the Joseph P. and Rose F. Kennedy Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School and Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at Massachusetts General Hospital. Rudy, glad you could join us.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
This is an incredibly complex mix. And yet you say that you think that we're seeing the light of day. And I wonder what makes you say that. Do you see treatments in the pipeline that you think hold real promise at this point?
Well, I think we're seeing the light of day in that we're making fewer mistakes. You know, every pharma company that tried to target the plaques in order to improve the cognition of patients, you know, somehow reduce the degree of dementia, has failed simply because those plaques, they did their job 10, 20 years ago. It's kind of like the plaque is like the match. The tangles are like the brush fires that spread. You can live with it. But once there's neuroinflammation, that's the forest fire. And that's self-feeding, right? So as neurons die, you get more neuroinflammation. Neuroinflammation causes more cells to die. So you get this vicious cycle. And meanwhile, the plaques and the tangles just help you get there. So you can imagine if you're treating a patient where neuroinflammation is rampant in the brain, killing nerve cells, and you try to blow out the match when the forest fire is already raging, of course it's not going to work. I think for early detection, early intervention, yes, target the plaques and tangles because that's the initiating pathology. That's how we'll stop current and future generations from getting the disease. But for patients who are suffering right now, there are 5.8 million of them in this country. You need to stop neuroinflammation. We estimate there are up to 40 million people in this country who need early intervention right now. That's where we are developing different types of drugs, including in my lab with the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, developing what are called gamma secretase modulators, where we hope that they'll be more like the statins, the way you take a Lipitor or a statin to stop heart disease 10, 20 years before when your cholesterol is high. Same idea, if you know your amyloid is high in your brain, you start taking a drug to bring that amyloid plaque down. But you have to do it early on. I mean, imagine if you had a heart attack, congestive heart failure, and your cardiologist said, here, just take some Lipitor and go home. Obviously, that's not enough. But that's the equivalent of what we're doing with trials that are trying to treat amyloid in patients who already have symptoms.
Rudy Tanzi, speaking of trying to catch things early, I mean, several years ago, we did hear that there were preventative trials looking at people who were at higher risk of familial Alzheimer's and trying to treat early. Where did those go? Have we learned anything yet from those?
They're still going. The trials that are going on there, Risa Sperling here at Mass General Harvard, we're working with her on some of those studies. And, you know, they take a long time. You have to track folks who have plaques but no symptoms, and you have to track them for at least five years or more to see if taking a certain drug that stops the plaques will postpone when they get clinical symptoms. So those prevention-type trials take a long time. Pharma companies are unwilling to do them for the most part, so we do them in academia. And you can imagine for a pharma company, right, to do a 10-year trial at the level they do them, that could cost billions of dollars. By the time the trial is done, your drug could be off patent and it's a generic. So the system is not really made to favor these long prevention trials. That's why we have to do them at a lower scale in academia. The problem is you don't have a whole lot of people in them because you can't afford to do a multi-billion dollar trial, you know, in a nonprofit in academia. I think at some point the FDA has to work together with the companies and with the academics to say, look, if we all agree that plaques come early and the genetics show they come early, if we have a drug that's economically feasible, that people can take and the healthcare can afford and it's safe, let's put it out there and let's depend on real world evidence, as we call it, or real world data, and see if over time the population is getting less Alzheimer's because we allowed a safe drug out there that hits the plaques.
Well, Rudy Tanzi, in the meantime, what do we know about lifestyle choices that might be protective for those who are worried about developing Alzheimer's?
Well, you know, this is why I write books, and not to promote my own books, but I did write 3 popular trade books on that. But in those books, we come up with basically 6 different categories. And I use the acronym SHIELD, which will likely be the title of my next book. And SHIELD stands for, S stands for sleep. Get your 7 to 8 hours. You need that deep sleep in order to clean the brain out of the plaque and debris that causes the disease 10, 20 years before symptoms. If you can't get 7 or 8 hours of sleep straight, take power naps. It's right after the dream sleep or REM that the brain does its cleaning out. So you want to have as many of those cycles as you can. H stands for handling stress, so meditation and dealing with stress. Stress causes inflammation. I is interaction, or you could say integration, not isolating yourself, but staying actively engaged with others. Relationships are very helpful for the brain. Loneliness, not being alone, but being alone and not liking it. Loneliness is a risk factor. It increases risk for Alzheimer's twofold. Exercise, we published a big paper about exercise last year in Science. We showed that exercise induces the birth of new nerve cells in the part of the brain that's most affected in Alzheimer's disease, the short-term memory area. And it also induces growth factors that protect those nerve cells when they're born and help the brain get better. So exercise also helps get rid of the plaque. Get your blood flowing for at least a half hour a day, even if it's just a brisk walk. L stands for learning new things. So I like to say, you know, if you're learning something new while I'm telling you this stuff, I'm helping you. If I'm putting you to sleep, I'm still helping you. D is diet. So Mediterranean diet has been shown to be the best diet for the brain in various studies. And keeping your gut microbiome happy. You know, Your gut microbiome is the bacteria. The trillions of bacteria that live in your gut are directly affecting your brain health. And so keeping them healthy, and a lot of people take probiotics, you know, or eat yogurt and probiotic foods, and that's great, but it's not enough. You have to also feed those bacteria what they like to eat. They like prebiotics or plant fiber. They like whole grains. They like plant fiber, peas, lentils. So think about your fiber and your diet, because that's what those bacteria like to munch on, and that's what keeps them happy. So that's SHIELD.
Rudy Tanzi is the Kennedy Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School, Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at Mass General Hospital, and author of many books, apparently upcoming the book SHIELD. Thanks for all the recommendations, Rudy.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Up next, 1 in 4 American women get an abortion at some point. We'll explore what we know about who they are and what drives their choices when we come back. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The debate over abortion rights has been thrust front and center in recent weeks by several new state laws restricting access to the procedure and also multiple court challenges to those laws. The public discourse around the issue is heated and emotional, and understandably so. The choice to have an abortion is intensely personal. As a result, we often hear the individual stories of women who have chosen to have an abortion, why they made that choice, what impact it had on their lives. But we rarely get the big picture. How many women opt for abortion? Who are they? And what most often drives their decisions? That's exactly what my next guest has written about for TheConversation.com. Lou Ireland is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UMass Medical School. Lou, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Your piece for The Conversation is full of facts and statistics that I, at least, had never encountered before, starting with the fact that 1 in 4 American women will have an abortion before their 45th birthday. I don't think that's a widely known statistic. I'm not sure we've had a good sense of how common this procedure is.
Yes, it is a very, very common procedure. You know, as an obstetrician gynecologist, I have the privilege of taking care of women and seeing how frequently the service is needed. You know, when you think that each woman has 30 years of life of being fertile and needing to prevent pregnancy, you can see how unplanned pregnancy becomes so, so common.
And in fact, you cite another statistic that a 2011 survey found that nearly half of all pregnancies were unintended, and that 42% of women with unintended pregnancies would opt for abortion.
That is correct. You know, that number has dropped since the Affordable Care Act has made contraception more available. Between 2008 and 2011, there was a 6% drop in the unintended pregnancy rate, but it still remains a big public health issue.
And I think one of the things that was most surprising to me in your piece was the fact that more than half of women who opt to have an abortion already have at least one other child. These are mothers.
Absolutely. These are people who know what it means to continue a pregnancy to term, know what it means to recover postpartum, and know what it means to parent. And I have never taken care of a patient who has made the decision to have an abortion lightly.
Well, Lou Ireland, what else do we know about who the women who opt for abortion are in terms of things like age, education, race, income?
Sure. I think the fundamental thing to note, which you mentioned, is that abortion is extremely common. So when we talk about 1 in 4 women, we're talking about our family, our friends, our coworkers, our neighbors, people that we love and trust to make good decisions. When we're talking at large, you know, the vast majority of women who choose abortion are in their 20s. Mainly between the ages of 20 to 24. That makes up about a third of women who choose abortion. And then the second largest group would be between the ages of 25 to 29. As you mentioned, almost 60% of women who choose abortion have already given birth and understand what it means to parent. And then half of women who choose abortion live under less than 100% of the federal poverty level. So these are women who are poor, who make an average of about $19,000 for a family of three. So not being able to afford to parent is a huge motivator in choosing to end a pregnancy. When it comes to race and ethnicity, people of all races and ethnicities choose abortions. The largest group is white women, which make up almost 40%, followed by black women, which make up 27% of women who choose abortion. In my research of this, one of the things that I was surprised to note was that all religions are represented when it comes to people who choose abortion, with Catholic women making up the largest group at about 24%.
Well, Lou Ireland, let's dig into what we do know about what typically drives the choice to have an abortion. You know, many of the new laws that we're seeing passed or the debate often highlights things like the health of the mother and the health of the fetus. But a 2004 survey found that only 7% of women cited those kinds of health concerns in their choices. So what's driving most abortion choices?
So a great study in 2004 looked at over 1,000 women choosing abortion and broke down what their main reasons for choosing abortion was. The number one reason that people chose was that they were not ready for a child or another child, that timing was wrong. And specifically, they felt like continuing a pregnancy and parenting would interfere with their education, interfere with their employment, or interfere with the ability to take care of their children or other dependents. And then the second most common reason was not being able to afford to parent another child. This is definitely reflected in the patients that I have taken care of. I can't tell you the number of women that I've taken care of who come to me with children and say, I didn't want to make this decision, but I have to because I need to be able to parent the children that I have. Similarly with, you know, education, you know, recently I took care of a young woman who was the first person in her family to go to college, and she wanted to be able to be the first person to graduate. And, you know, a pregnancy was not in line with those plans.
Well, Lou Ireland, another thing that you highlight in your piece for theconversation.com is the fact that, as we've already noted, that, you know, despite the fact that most women who opt for abortion are facing some sort of financial hardship, more than half pay out of pocket for this procedure.
That is absolutely correct. And it's a, you know, huge financial burden for women. And that's, you know, another piece that adds to the stigma of abortion. All the ways in which we treat abortion as separate from other medical procedures, you know, add to this culture that abortion is wrong or shouldn't be done. In my research for the article, I came across a statistic that's 58% of people who choose an abortion keep it secret from their family members and their friends. And this is not out of regret, because we know that 95% of people who choose abortion feel like it was the right decision and have no regret about getting the procedure.
Lou Ireland, as a medical provider, I wonder, we already talked about the fact that concerns about health or well-being, either of the mother or of the fetus, is the deciding factor in the minority of cases. Another thing that gets very high-profile coverage in the media and in the public discourse that's also a minority case is abortions later in pregnancy. The vast majority of abortions do take place during the first trimester. But as a medical provider, how important is this procedure for those cases where there is a health concern, you know, that may not surface until later in the pregnancy?
It is an absolutely vital part of patient care. So, you know, when, you know, like you mentioned, less than 1% of abortions happen in the third trimester. But when they do happen, you know, these are pregnancies where parents were very excited about parenting, went to prenatal care, were excited to see what they would see on ultrasounds, and then started seeing things that were not right.
A lot of debate, it's kind of an extra level of debate about abortion, comes down to how we talk about it, whether or not we use terms like pro-choice or pro-life, and whether we call it a fetus or an unborn child. When you, as a medical provider, Lou Ireland, are talking with a woman about this choice, What kind of language are you using?
You know, my goal as a physician is to build trust with my patients, make their experience as comfortable as possible. So a lot of times I'm following their leads. When I'm taking care of a woman who has a planned pregnancy with a fetal anomaly that is not going to continue, they may choose to use the word baby. Whereas, you know, if I'm seeing somebody with an unplanned pregnancy, you know, that might not be the language that I choose.
How different do you think the public discourse and public debate about abortion rights would be if more people, I guess, shared your understanding of abortion, of how common it is and what drives these decisions for women?
Well, I think that the public discourse, especially what we see when we turn on social media or what we turn on the radio or turn on the TV, is different than the majority of opinion in our country. So, you know, when we step away from what we title ourselves, I'm pro-life, I'm pro-choice, when we talk about who wants abortion to remain legal, 79% of Americans want abortion to remain legal. That being said, going back to your question on public discourse, you know, right now when we do turn on those media outlets, we're often hearing from politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, you know, sharing very strong opinions on the topics. And the voice that we lack, like you said, are the pregnant people who actually choose abortions. You know, I think if those stories were more heard, more common, you know, my hope would be that we would realize this as a common procedure that it is, and that, you know, these are people that are just trying to live their best lives, have the best health, and have the best outcomes for them and their families.
And yet, of course, there are plenty of Americans who do oppose abortion on moral and ethical grounds. What would you say to them?
I would say that, you know, we live in a country where thankfully everybody has a right to their own opinions and to live their lives the way that they feel is right for them. I would say that the people who choose abortion, please remember these are people you know, people you love, people who live near you, who you work with, who you have over for dinner. And these are people who make these decisions, you know, with a lot of thought and a lot of reflection. And in the same way that you would trust these people to take care of your children, you need to trust them to make the best decision for themselves and their families.
Lou Ireland is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UMass Medical School, and you can find her piece, Who Are the 1 in 4 American Women Who Choose Abortion, on theconversation.com. Lou, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Say the word shark to a New Englander these days, and they'll probably jump straight to great white sharks. We've seen a remarkable increase in the numbers of white sharks along the Massachusetts coast in recent years. But great whites aren't the only sharks around. And it turns out we know precious little about many of the sharks that frequent New England's waters. Jeff Kneebone is a fisheries scientist with the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium, and much of his research focuses on figuring out where sharks are and what they're doing as they move around the region. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So, Jeff, we're all familiar with great white sharks at this point, but, you know, rough estimate, like how many different species of sharks are there in New England's waters on a regular basis?
That's a great question. So during the summer months, there's about 10 or so species of sharks that are really common to New England. We've got the white shark, obviously, the porbeagle shark, the mako shark, the common thresher shark, the blue shark, the basking shark. We also got sand tiger sharks, sandbar sharks, and the somewhat ubiquitous smooth dogfish and spiny dogfish sharks, which are often called sand sharks.
I have to say, of that whole list that you just went through, other than the dogfish, which I think most of us have probably heard of, a few others in there. I mean, I've never even heard of most of those sharks. And what a lot of your research seems to highlight is the fact that we don't necessarily know a whole lot about a lot of these species that are in our waters. And you've been specifically using tagging technology to try to track where these sharks are and maybe get a sense of what they're doing. I mean, what are these tags like and what can you really learn from them?
Well, there's a lot of different tag types that we use. Specifically, we use acoustic tags, which if anyone's familiar with the white shark tracking that occurs in the Cape, you basically put a small transmitter on an animal, and then you can monitor its movements with a series of fixed, what we call acoustic receivers. We often liken it to an easy pass system. So if you think of the easy pass toll booth as the acoustic receiver and the tagged shark as your car driving along the highway. And by placing these receivers all around the coast of Massachusetts, we can kind of get an idea of where animals are and how they're moving between areas. That's one major technology that we use. The other is satellite-based telemetry. So specifically for the tags that I use, we use what are called pop-up satellite tags. And basically these tags are just like little computers that you program to collect some information when they're on the shark. And at a specific time, they come off the animal, float to the surface, and transmit all the data that they've archived to a satellite, which then gets relayed back to us. We can just put together the history of the shark from the back end, if that makes sense.
So, Jeff Niebone, as you mentioned, one of the projects that you and your colleagues at the Anderson Cabot Center are currently working on is tagging and tracking those sandbar sharks, also known to recreational fishermen, I guess, as brown sharks. And these are sharks that are targeted by recreational fishermen, right?
The brown sharks are targeted extensively by recreational fishermen, predominantly from the beach and the Cape and the islands. And they're an interesting shark because they are just seasonal visitors to New England. So they're coming up here when the water warms up in the summer. And they're a protected or prohibited shark species in that they have to be released when they were caught, when they are caught. There was actually a pretty big fishery for them that existed off the mid-Atlantic coast about, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago, and the populations kind of dropped. So the fishery was closed for them a while back now. And given their, you know, susceptibility to depletion and their history of kind of having low populations in the last few decades, we're just trying to get an idea of how the fish survive when they're caught and released. So we want to know if the catch and release process is harming the fish in any way. And if it is, we want to work with fishermen to try to figure out what is it about the capture event that is causing the sharks to die. So is it where they're being hooked? Is it how long they're being fought? Is it how they're being handled when they're landed on the beach? And keeping the welfare of the animals in mind, we'd recommend that you do this or that to maximize the chance that the fish that you catch survive when they're released.
So how do you actually go about doing that kind of research, and where do the tags that we were just talking about factor in?
To do the research, we just partner with fishermen who are already going out in the area and, you know, catching these fish for fun, for recreation. And we just observe their behaviors, you know, let them fish as normal. And then we come in once the animals are landed on the beach and tag them with a slightly different type of tag than I described previously. These we call acceleration data logger tags. They collect really high resolution data about the animal's swimming behavior. So, you know, we can track every time it beats its tail, whether it's stopped swimming, whether it's moving vertically. And that data is really, wow. It can be likened to like having a Fitbit on a shark. That's the kind of way we describe it.
Well, Jeff Niebone, you've also tagged common thresher sharks, which you mentioned earlier. That's a species that's actually caught commercially, right? What are they actually used for? Why are they targeted?
So, yeah, common threshers are targeted commercially, but not super extensively. They're actually more of a bycatch species in inshore gillnet fisheries and some trawl fisheries, but they're actually quite good to eat, and the meat is sold for human consumption. For recreational fishing, they're even more popular than the commercial fishing because they are very hard-fighting fish. They jump a lot, and they're just really fun for anglers to catch. So they're highly targeted by the recreational fleet. And to put on top of that, they are pretty good to eat. So it's kind of like the perfect package for a recreational sport fish.
I was really interested to learn from the website of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that this is considered a sustainable fishery, but the state of the population has never been formally assessed, and it is presumed to be stable. What do we know about the population, and what else could we learn from the kind of tagging work that you've done?
That's a great question, and it's very true. The state of the common thresher population in the North Atlantic is not well known, and that's really all stems back to the fact that we don't know that much about them. We don't have a lot of data, and they haven't really gotten a lot of attention scientifically until recently. So just basically, we know that they exist throughout the entire North Atlantic Ocean, basically from our neck of the woods here in North America. They exist, you know, up to Newfoundland, and then they also occur in the Eastern Atlantic off the UK and Ireland. But we don't know if the population is all connected. So in other words, do the sharks that we have over here swim all the way over to Europe and vice versa? So the basic population structure is pretty unknown, and that's basically a fundamental input for fish population assessment. So that's where the tagging work comes in. We're trying to figure out, well, what is this population doing on a broader level throughout the Atlantic using the satellite tags and the acoustic tags. And that's like the first piece of the puzzle to trying to figure out what the status of their population is.
Jeff Niebone is an associate research scientist at the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you guys so much.
Up next, could the newest wireless technology transform the way we work? Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. 5G. It's rare that a number and a letter create so much excitement. It literally just means the fifth generation of wireless technology, and it promises faster service, more data, and more devices connected to each other. U.S. cell phone companies have unveiled new 5G phones and small 5G networks this year, and more is coming. But it's not just about better cell service. The last generation, 4G, is widely credited with enabling things like the rise of online shopping and services like Uber. Now, analysts say 5G technology could do the same for virtual reality and the Internet of Things. The result, they say, could be revolutionary. Think virtual reality dressing rooms for online shopping, or smart homes that make Nest and voice-controlled light switches look like dunces. And of course, 5G could transform many industries, not just communication and media, but manufacturing, healthcare, even agriculture. And as industries transform, so does the experience of workers. Muriel Medard is the Cecil H. Green Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT, and she'll be talking about 5G and the future of work at MTech 19, a conference at MIT later this week. Muriel, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
When we say things like 4G, 5G, going from one generation to the next, that sounds like incremental improvement. We're going to have more data. It's going to be faster. What makes this so revolutionary?
So one of the things that's interesting and the reason people are wondering whether this is really going to be, if you will, quite revolutionary and different is that there is in 5G versus, let's say, former rollouts, there's more of an emphasis on integrating 5G with other aspects of wireless, which up until now had been somewhat separate.
Like what?
So, you know, you mentioned Nest or light switches, but, you know, people are looking at this for vehicle technologies. So car-to-car communications for safety and possibly self-driving down the road. They're thinking of things like haptic networks, so where you might have sufficiently low delays that you could have applications where it feels like you're feeling things, so for things like remote medicine and so on. So the thing I would say that's a bit different about 5G versus how the other generations were envisaged is this emphasis from the beginning rather than post hoc to incorporate a variety of different applications from Internet of Things, vehicular, even satellite, which up until now had been very separate.
And how does that play out in terms of user experience? I mean, how different will daily life be? What will it look like?
It's a good question, and I don't think anybody knows. It's just me. Because, you know, in some respects, many of the final aspects of 5G have not been nailed down. Some of the standardization that has taken place in many cases does not look exactly light years away from what we knew in 4G. And so, you know, while definitely being an improvement, it's not clear that those by themselves are, if you will, quantum leaps. So it's not quite clear what will happen.
Muriel Medard, let's talk about a couple of the things that have created a lot of excitement about what 5G could do. And one of those is virtual reality and augmented reality. And you already mentioned this idea that connections might be fast enough that you could almost feel, not just, you know, talk to somebody on the other end of a computer Skype connection. Is that speed and data need kind of what's holding virtual reality or augmented reality back from being commonplace? And could 5G make it a common part of daily life?
One of the things to remember is that when you're talking about wireless environments, there's a lot of uncertainty because it's, you know, it's actually both sparse in how we use it and crowded. Think of a road which maybe has a lot of lanes, and each user just needs one lane at a time. Now, if the road were better, maybe it could go faster. But think that the roads right now have a lot of potholes. This is something that's familiar to us living in Massachusetts.
Absolutely.
And you also have to worry about other drivers basically coming in and out of your lane and also slowing you down. That's what we call multi-user interference. That's the person next door turning on the microwave. That's maybe somebody on the Wi-Fi in a crowded area with you. So even though you may say, you know, that you have a brand new road, as obstacles show up on the road and as other drivers show up on the road, it all becomes a little iffy. Many of you probably have looked at buying an internet connection. Often you have, you know, speeds up to, well, you know, the up to is an upper bound.
Right.
What do you reliably get? If you start an application, do you know that you're going to have robust provisioning of that level of service during the entire time that you're using the application? And that's always been one of the very tricky parts about anything that's wireless. Now, one of the aspects that 5G is trying to do is to use what I would say is tough real estate spectrum. Okay, so basically people have already built the roads in the nice flat parts. That's where a lot of the earlier versions like 3G, 4G have been. That's where a lot of the Wi-Fi also lives. But now think that those roads are getting, you know, pretty crowded. What you do is you start looking for the real estate where nobody has made any roads. You have a lot of space there. You can make, you know, multi-lane highways. But there was a reason people hadn't built roads there. It's not going to be easy.
So we're talking about using different parts of the radio spectrum to be able to just open things up.
Exactly. And the very high frequencies, you just have a lot more spectrum available. But they're more challenging.
Muriel Medard, when we think about this idea of 5G creating infinite lane highways, essentially, for the rapid, almost instantaneous transfer of large amounts of data. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, we could all stream our favorite movies all the time, but this also has a lot of ramifications for a lot of industries. And what you're going to be talking about at the MTech 2019 conference later this week is how this could play out in the future of work. So what are some of the ways that you see the advent of 5G affecting our workplaces and our work lives?
So I think this goes back very much to what we just talked about in terms of the reliability. If one can count on reliable services that allow remote operation of certain aspects of our work lives, not just, of course, what we're used to right now, which would be, say, a teleconference, that's already changed the way people work quite a bit. But having, I hesitate to say virtual reality, but, you know, let's say a more enhanced presence or more wide variety of applications, then that could really change where we work and what the expectations are also of how people interact with each other.
So telecommuting more often or more widely, and then the possibility you were just mentioning of almost like virtual meetings, virtual conferences. I mean, the first thing that springs to mind for me is that, of course, if you go to a conference, the most useful part is always the part in between the sessions, which is never going to be, you know, webcast or broadcast. Maybe this would enable you to have the water cooler experience as well as the meeting experience.
Yes, what is often called the networking side, even though it's the only part that actually uses no networking in the technical sense, exactly. So I think that those are some of the aspects, but also, you know, maybe having more reliable data feeds, more reliable video feeds, being able to access your data with more ease across different regions, being able to cache, which is in effect pre-place some data for easy access, so that shared work is more readily done. I mean, nowadays we know very often when we're with coworkers, you know, we'll have difficulty sharing documents. You know, there's certain aspects.
It's a difficulty we know all too well. Yes.
It's a difficulty we all know well. But you know, if you're trying to do something which is more advanced, like you're trying to do some very distributed processing on data, then having that data be consistent and available across a wide number of users who themselves may be quite geo-dispersed, that sort of ability can really change what the expectations are.
Well, Muriel Madard, the idea that 5G could enhance collaboration sounds great. But on the other hand, we hear a lot about 5G enhancing the Internet of Things, allowing machines to talk to each other more easily. And I wonder, could 5G... one of its major impacts on the workplace be the acceleration of this trend we're already seeing of automation moving into the workplace, the quote-unquote robot takeover that some people are worried about?
I think that, you know, I'm more on the technology side, not really on the side of, you know, the history of labor. But certainly that's also something that one needs to be, I think, wary and conscious of, that there not be unintended consequences. From the economic side, I don't know what would happen. You know, as I said, for instance, data and collaboration will allow maybe people who had been shut out of the workforce to be included, or whether there will be a wider disparity, in particularly between communities that have access to a very very robust services versus those that don't. So I think that from a societal perspective is certainly a concern that should be addressed probably ahead of time rather than post facto.
Muriel Madard is the Cecil H. Green Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT. She'll be talking about 5G and the future of work at MTech 2019, a conference at MIT later this week. Muriel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. You can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We're not on virtual reality yet. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.